This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Picture a convention center, not a church basement, not a tent revival on the edge of some rural country road. A full convention center, 10,000 seats, 10,000 people, every one of them there voluntarily, every one of them convinced that the man at the podium had cracked the code on how to live a righteous life. This is the 1970s and 80s, city after city, governors endorsing him by name, sitting U.S. senators on his board of directors, families driving hundreds of miles, taking notes, going home and rebuilding their entire lives around what this man told them. His name is Bill Gothard. He has never been ordained, never married, holds no accredited theological degree. He is, by every traditional measure of religious authority, completely unqualified to tell a single person how to live. He is 91 years old now. He lives in his childhood home in Illinois. He still runs something called Embassy University Online, still issues teachings, still calls himself a minister. Zero criminal charges ever. He's denied every allegation of misconduct ever made against him. And we'll get to those allegations, but sit with that number for a second. Zero, because everything that follows is going to make that harder to explain. Gothard started in 1961. He was in his mid-20s, no credentials, working with teenagers in Chicago under the name Campus Teams. What he had instead of credentials was a system, a clean, confident, scripture-wrapped answer to the questions that every anxious evangelical parent in post-war America was already asking. How do I raise my children right in a world that feels like it's falling apart? I don't know why I turned into Donna Adelson there, but I did. He called the organization the Institute in Basic Life Principles, IBLP. And the core of it was simple enough to put a bumper sticker with it, which is probably part of why it worked. Seven basic principles. Follow them and you are protected. Deviate and you suffer consequences. God's rules are not suggestions. Obedience is not optional. Here's what that looked like in actual practice. Fathers are the supreme authority in the home. Their word is functionally God's word to their family. Wives submit to husbands completely. Children never leave home until they marry. Daughters remain under their father's authority until that authority is formally transferred to a husband. Adult sons, even after they marry and move out, remain spiritually accountable to their fathers. There is no age at which you simply become a person who makes your own decisions. The exit ramp doesn't exist. Gothard called this the umbrella of protection. Stay under it. Nothing bad can reach you. Step outside it through rebellion, through independence, through the act of making a choice your father didn't sanction. And you are, in the language of IBLP, actually used practicing witchcraft. That is the word they used, not metaphorically, as doctrine. The homeschooling program was called ATI, the Advanced Training Institute, launched in 1984. 54 pamphlets called wisdom books. No sex education, because Gothard believed that was exclusively the parents' domain. No critical thinking curriculum, no engagement with ideas outside the framework. Former students describe graduating and discover they couldn't function in basic academic or professional environments. Big gaps in math, science, fundamental knowledge of the world outside the community. The program promised a high school equivalent education. What it delivered, according to many who actually went through it, was a closed loop specifically designed to keep you inside of it. IBLP also dispensed medical guidance. If a doctor told a woman another pregnancy could kill her, the pamphlet said that fear was from Satan. Yes. Doctors say no more kids. That's the devil. Medical decisions made from fear give the deceiver a foothold on your home. Mental illness doesn't exist as a clinical condition. It's a spiritual irresponsibility. And IBLP formally endorsed the parenting methods of Michael and Debbie Pearl, a discipline approach that has been linked in news reports to the deaths of three children. Millions of families signed up for this. They weren't uniformed people. They were parents who watched the culture shift in the 1960s and 1970s and wanted something stable, something authoritative, something that pushed back. Gothard had certainty, and certainty, when you're afraid, is extremely attractive. He understood his market perfectly. Now, here's a piece that requires you to hold two things in your head at once. The man who built this system, who told parents he would keep their children safe inside the umbrella, who recruited families into a framework of total submission and total protection, was, according to more than 30 women who eventually came forward, systematically targeting young women inside his own organization. Gothard has denied all of these allegations, every one of them. But here is what the documented record shows. Gothard recruited girls as young as 16 to come work at IBLP headquarters as his personal secretaries. He told their parents they were special, pure, chosen. The parents, who had been taught that Gothard's authority was an extension of God's own, sent their daughters willingly. The girls lived at the facility. They had unsupervised access to Gothard. They were teenagers. He was the most powerful person in their world. In 1980, years before most people had ever heard of IBLP, Gothard's own brother, Steve, was caught in misconduct with young women inside the organization. Surprise! There was a scandal. There was a restructuring. Gothard appeared contrite, stepped back briefly, and then the organization continued. It didn't collapse. It grew. The 1980 scandal didn't end IBLP. It taught IBLP how to survive one. And by 2012, a website called Recovering Grace began publishing first-hand accounts of Gothard's alleged behavior. Women describing a pattern of grooming, unwanted touching, and manipulation going back decades. These accounts were publicly available, findable by anyone who looked. And in 2014, more than 30 women had come forward, and the IBLP board placed Gothard on administrative leave while other outside legal counsel investigated. Their conclusion, no criminal activity was found. He had, however, acted, and I'm quoting the official IBLP statement directly, in an inappropriate manner. That's what 30-plus accusers got. Inappropriate manner. He resigned. He denied everything. Among the allegations, all of which Gothard denies, one woman alleges essay. Alleged it happened in Gothard's private suite at IBLP headquarters when she was 17 or 18 years old. That allegation became part of an amended civil lawsuit filed in 2016 when 10 women sued Gothard and IBLP for harassment, assault, and institutional cover-up. Here's what those women got. The lawsuit was voluntarily dismissed in 2018. The plaintiffs cited what they called unique complexities with the statute of limitations. In their dismissal statement, they wrote, "We are not recanting our experiences or dismissing the incalculable damage that we believe Gothard has done." They didn't drop the case because they stopped believing what happened to them. They dropped it because the legal system gave them nowhere to go. There's something in the court documents and survivor accounts. Gothard denies all of it, but how he allegedly treated women who came to him, having already survived abuse. Survivors described coming to Gothard for counseling after being victimized by fathers or family members. According to those accounts, he pressured them for explicit details. He told them that if they hadn't cried out to God during their assault, they bore equal responsibility for what happened. And then, according to those same accounts, he subjected them to unwanted physical contact during the counseling sessions themselves. I know. It's like, how does this exist? The system that suppresses S education produces children who don't recognize abuse when it happens. The authority structure ensures they don't report it. And the man at the top of that structure allegedly targeted women who had already been victimized, subjected them to further harm, and handed them a theology that made it their fault. The machine processed its own victims back to itself. No criminal charges ever. The statute of limitations is a powerful thing when your organization is built to delay, discourage, and doctrinally prohibit the act of reporting to any authority outside the church. Today, IBLP operates out of a 223-acre compound in Big Sandy, Texas, a property originally purchased by Hobby Lobby's David Green and transferred to the organization. ATI ended its formal enrollment program in 2021. Some of the wisdom booklets are still for sale. Gothard runs Embassy University from his childhood home. Hundreds of thousands of families went through this system, not just the Duggars. The Duggars are the ones who ended up on national television, which is the only reason you know their names. But there were families in every state, in every evangelical pocket of this country, who handed their children to this curriculum, this community, this theology, and whose children grew up inside the same conditions, the same silence, the same closed loop, and never made a single headline. Jim, Bob, and Michelle Degger attended their first IBLP seminar in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1985. They went home and said it changed their lives. They'd spend the next three decades as its most famous advertisement, smiling, modest, perfectly wholesome proof that Gothard system worked. They were wrong about that. We're going to spend the next four episodes explaining exactly what went wrong. Before we get to the family, you need to understand the machine, who built it, what it was designed to do, and the fact that the man who built it is 91 years old, still online, still operating, and has never once been held criminally accountable for any of it. That's your foundation. Everything else gets built on top of it. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. We're going to break it down throughout the week today, or throughout the week this week here on the program. So we'll continue there. And continue our conversation in the comments section. Love for you to weigh in. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
I'm starting to have nightmares about these people. Are you? Every night for years, a grandmother locked a little girl's bedroom door from the inside, not because of strangers, not because of a bad neighborhood, because of a man sleeping down the hall. Her own husband. Mary Duggar did this for her granddaughter, Amy, every single night. Amy's mother, Dina, would check on her too. Two women working in quiet coordination, building a barrier between a child and the man of the house. Nobody told Amy why. She just knew the rules. Grandpa doesn't take you to school. Grandpa doesn't watch movies with you alone. Grandpa doesn't play with you on the trampoline. There were so many restrictions that Amy eventually stopped asking about them. That's just how it was. The sky was blue, the grass was green, and you were never alone with Grandpa. Amy Duggar King didn't learn the reason, allegedly, until after her grandfather, Jimmy Lee Duggar, died in 2009. That's when her mother finally told her the truth, allegedly. In her 2025 memoir, Holy Disruptor, Amy describes her grandfather with the word her mother gave her, predator. The women in the Duggar family had known what Jimmy Lee was for decades. They'd known it clearly enough to build a system of physical protection around the children in his orbit. And they never said the word out loud, not once, until he was gone. That silence is the story, not just what Jimmy Lee did, but what happened, because the family's only response was to quietly manage the threat instead of naming it. Because three generations later, the same pattern is still producing the same results. And the people who could have broken that cycle chose locked doors instead. Jimmy Lee Duggar was born in 1936 in Fayetteville, Arkansas. He married Mary Leona Lester in 1960. They had two children, Deanna and James Robert. Jim Bob. Jimmy Lee and Mary owned a real estate brokerage. On the surface, a normal Arkansas family. According to Amy's memoir, the reality underneath it was something else entirely. Amy writes that Jimmy Lee was an alcoholic with a violent temper and a history of infidelity. She describes a childhood environment where he could be charming and funny one moment and terrifying the next. By the time Amy and her cousins reached junior high, according to the book, they'd learned to be cautious around him. The funny grandfather had a side the family didn't talk about. But Deanna knew. According to Amy, her mother never took a shower if Jimmy Lee was home. She locked her own bedroom door at night. So same protective behavior she'd later extend to Amy. Deanna had lived with the full weight of her father's behavior since childhood. Amy's memoir alleges two specific incidents of extreme violence against Deanna. In one, Jimmy Lee allegedly beat her with a leather belt for over an hour, leaving her severely injured. In another, after learning Deanna planned to move in with a boyfriend, he allegedly grabbed her by the throat, pinned her to a bed, and attempted to strangle her. According to Amy, it was Jim Bob who physically intervened during one of these attacks to protect his sister. That detail matters. Jim Bob Duggar, the man who would later build a media empire on the image of a wholesome Christian family, personally witnessed his own father's capacity for violence. He wasn't shielded from it. He stepped into it. He saw what Jimmy Lee was. And there's more to Jimmy Lee's record than what happened inside the home. According to reporting confirmed by Amy, her grandfather also spent time in jail in the 1980s, a fraud charge connected to a car deal. Details are scarce and the sentence length is unknown, but the point is clear. Jimmy Lee Duggar had a criminal record while his children were still young. This wasn't a man whose problems were invisible. They were visible to anyone who was paying attention. The family paid attention. They just decided the right response was management, not accountability. How effective was the silence? When Amy's cousin Jill Duggar read Holy Disruptor after its release in October of 2025, her husband Derek ended up telling her things about her own grandfather that she didn't know. Jill said publicly that they'd had inklings of things growing up, but the book revealed family history she'd never been told directly. A woman who grew up in that family, in that house, surrounded by those same cautious adults, and still didn't fully understand what had been happening under the roof. That's how complete the silence was. It didn't just keep outsiders in the dark. It kept the grandchildren in the dark, too. The women who locked the doors succeeded at one thing. Amy was not victimized by her grandfather. But the strategy had a cost they couldn't see. By protecting without naming, by managing without confronting, they built a template. And the next generation inherited it perfectly. Josh Duggar, Jim Bob's eldest son, began doing anything to minors when he was a teenager. His victims included four of his own sisters and a babysitter. According to police reports and court testimony, the abuse involved repeated inappropriate contact while his sisters slept, while they sat in his lap, while they were in the laundry room. The youngest known victim was 5 years old. According to sworn testimony from family friend Bobby Holt, Jim Bob and Michelle Duggar learned about the abuse in 2002, allegedly. Their response followed a pattern that should sound familiar by now. They handled it internally. Josh was disciplined at home. He was sent away for several months in 2003, not to a licensed treatment program, but to a construction work family, or to a construction work program with a family friend, framed later as rehabilitation. When he returned, Jim Bob took him to meet Joseph Hutchins, an Arkansas state trooper and family acquaintance, for what was described as a stern talk. Hutchins did not file a report. He did not contact child abuse hotlines. He did not take anything official down or any sort of action. He reportedly gave Josh a talking to and left it at that. And then Hutchins himself was later convicted on CSAM material charges and sentenced to 56 years in federal prison. I know, you can't make it up. The church elders were told, Jim and Bobby Holt, close family friends, were told in 2006 when the Duggar family was scheduled to appear on the Oprah Winfrey Show, an anonymous tipster, later identified as a friend of the Holt's daughter, contacted both the show's producers and Arkansas child abuse hotlines. Oprah's team canceled the appearance, thank God, and alerted authorities. By the time law enforcement investigated meaningfully, the statute of limitations had expired. Josh Duggar was never criminally charged for what he did with his sisters and the babysitter. The public didn't learn any of this until 2015 when In Touch Weekly published police reports. TLC canceled 19 Kids and Counting. But here's the thing about the timeline. Between the abuse, the internal handling, the Hutchins meeting, and the eventual cancellation, more than a decade passed. A decade in which the Duggar family built a television brand, a political identity, and a financial empire, all while sitting on the knowledge of what their eldest son had done to their daughters. This wasn't just that was managed. Before any of it became public, Amy stumbled onto something of her own, allegedly. Her father had purchased an old laptop from Joshy. When Amy started using it, she found a folder labeled Josh's files. Inside, according to Amy, were explicit images, material that horrified her. She told Jim Bob, and according to Amy's account, Jim Bob dismissed it immediately. He told her Josh had bought the computer from a pawn shop. The files must have belonged to someone else. His son would never look at such material. Surprise! Amy was a teenager. She brought evidence directly to the head of the family, and the head of the family looked at it and decided, allegedly, it wasn't what it obviously was. Years later, after Josh's 21 federal arrest for receiving and possessing that sort of material, agents from Homeland Security showed up at Amy's door. They asked her about the same computer, the one Jim Bob had explained away. The locked door strategy from Jimmy Lee's era had evolved. It wasn't just a grandmother quietly turning a deadbolt anymore. It was an entire infrastructure, church elders, IBLP leadership, a compliant state trooper, a family media brand generating millions, and a father who could hold evidence in his hands and choose not to see it. The silence didn't just continue from one generation to the next. It professionalized. It developed institutions. It built a machine. And then March 2026 happened. Joseph Duggar. The man that kind of looks like the Gerber baby as an adult. Not Josh. A different son. The seventh of Jim and Michelle's 19 children. Lucky number seven. Was arrested on March 18th in Taneytown, Arkansas. According to the Bay County Sheriff's Office in Florida, a now 14-year-old girl disclosed in a forensic interview that Joseph had allegedly, to her on multiple occasions during a 2020 family vacation in Panama City Beach. She was nine. According to the arrest affidavit, Joseph allegedly asked the child repeatedly to sit on his lap, then asked her to sit beside him on a couch and covered them with a blanket. The victim alleged he manipulated her clothing and made contact with her body while other family members were in the same room. I mean, the audacity, the arrogance, the it's just, like, deplorably evil. He is deplorably evil. If these allegations are true, and according to the reports, He admitted to it on the phone, so. The victim's father confronted Joseph on March 17th to 26th. According to the sheriff's office, Joseph admitted his actions to his father. Tinytown police then arranged a recorded phone call. The father called Joseph with a detective listening, and Joseph allegedly admitted it again. He was charged with behavior involving of a victim under 12. And by a person 18 or older. Meaning he was 18 or older, she was under that age. That's how those things work. You're like, why aren't you saying the words? Because we'd like to not be flagged by YouTube. Because we'd like to just be able to tell you the news story as grown-ups. But unfortunately, certain words people don't like. Both Florida charges are classified as life felonies, carrying either a life sentence or a minimum split sentence of at least 25 years, followed by probation or community control for life. He waived extradition on March 20th after his release in the Washington County custody. On March 27th, he was transferred to Bay County to face the charges. His wife, Kendra, was separately arrested and charged with 4 counts of second-degree child endangerment and 4 counts of second-degree false imprisonment. A no-contact order bars Kendra from any contact with the 4 victims identified in her case, allegedly. Both have April 29th court dates in Elm Springs District Court on the Arkansas charges. 3 generations, grandfather allegedly identified as a predator by his own family, eldest son convicted and currently serving 12 and a half years in federal prison. Or grandson, rather. Now, represented by a new attorney, the same lawyer who defended R. Kelly in an ongoing effort to vacate that conviction. They picked the winners. And now, the second son, arrested grandson, allegedly confessing to the abuse of a 9-year-old child. Same family, same pattern, access, silence, and delayed accountability. Repeating on a loop. Amy Duggar King put the generational pattern on the record 5 months before Joseph's arrest. She published Holy Disruptor in October of 2025. She named her grandfather. She described the locked doors. She detailed the system of silence that protected the family's image at the expense of its children. After Joseph's arrest, Amy said publicly that he was the last person she expected. And then she asked a question that should keep everybody up at night. How many other survivors and victims are there? We've been asking the same thing. But the family's response to Amy's book tells you everything you need to know about whether the silence machine has stopped running. In January 26, 2 months before Joseph was arrested, an unnamed Duggar family member texted Amy calling her troublesome for what she'd written in Holy Disruptor, told her she was mistaken, that she'd remembered it wrong, that bringing it up causes harm. Amy posted the exchange publicly. 2 months later, Joseph was in handcuffs. Jim Bob and Michelle Duggar have issued a brief statement expressing heartbreak. They have not addressed the general pattern. They have not addressed their father's alleged history. They have not addressed the system of silence that Amy, Jill, and multiple court records have now documented across decades. A locked door protects one child for one night. It tells that child, someone in this house sees the danger. Someone cares enough to turn the deadbolt, but it doesn't name the danger. It doesn't remove it. It doesn't warn the next family, the next generation, the next child who ends up on a couch under a blanket during a family vacation in Florida. It just keeps one bedroom safe and leaves everything else exactly the way it was. The women who lock those doors love their kids enough to protect them. But protection without confrontation is a temporary fix with a permanent cost. The Duggar family has been paying that cost for three generations. And based on everything we know right now, nobody in a position of authority inside that family has ever once chose to stop the cycle at the point where it actually starts, which is not at the bedroom door. It's at the moment someone with power decides that silence is more comfortable than the truth. Give us your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love to see them. And we'll continue our conversation there. Press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts. If you're enjoying our reporting, we do greatly appreciate that. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.